And you're about to hear a bit of a change-up to mostly talk, but we're going to throw some music on with Socialist Alternative Radio. And that's every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., talk and music from a working-class Democratic Socialist perspective. And that was you just listening. If you were just listening to our station, you heard Ear Buddies. And they're winding down the summer with their music. Really like that show. And we're going to, today, I think, put out more music than usual because I'm just feeling it in that mood. But we're going to be doing a lot of talk and basically maybe we'll be joined by Diego. My name is Jeff. I'll be your host today. Diego said he was going to try to make it in, but not sure that's going to happen now. And today's, you know, general, we always talk about more than we say we're going to talk about. And but generally, we're going to talk about an update on what's going on with an independent socialist, or actually a member of Social Alternative, who's running as an independent socialist and member of Social Alternative in Seattle for city council, going for a second re-election. That's Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A, last name Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T. We're going to give an update on that campaign, and we're going to talk about whether or not you're... Are you on vacation? Are you on a family vacation? Or do you feel this intense guilt that I feel as a parent and who's only been able to cobble together one brief family vacation? And I already have one of my children, one of our children, my wife, I shouldn't take total credit for this, my wife, Tina, and I, one of our children is now about to turn 14. And I'm just reminded of that birthday. His birthday's on Tuesday. Happy birthday, Justin, by the way. His birthday's on Tuesday. And, And we've managed like one family vacation in all that time. And that was just last year. And it was only for about 3 or 4 days. We went up to Montreal, which was great. But the off season, of course. But we didn't mind the cold. We just were happy to be on a vacation, right? So why is it that myself and many others, or our family and many other families, just don't do that anymore? When I was a kid and in a big family that was relatively not doing so well financially, why was it that we still were able to get family vacations together, I'd say most years, up until it gets a little more complicated in teenage years, when sullen teenagers like myself at the time and others, my brothers and sister, you know, didn't want to really participate or were working or whatever. But before that, I started working when I was 17, rah-rah, believe me, work is overrated for those of you that haven't started it yet. But anyway, you got to sell your labor. You're a wage slave under capitalism. Look it up if you don't believe me. Experience it if you don't believe me. But anyway, so there we are, winding down on the vacations in my teenage years, of course. But prior to that, you know, adolescent years and childhood years, I remember the vacation almost every year, which did put us in debt and did cause a lot of tension. How are we going to afford this or that? But we did it, you know, and I just get the feeling, it's anecdotal, that most Americans can't do that anymore. And that is a huge, huge problem, in my opinion, among many, many others, that, you know, families don't get that bit of little bit of time to themselves, you know, where they're not stressed out by work and or work and school demands. So right now we're doing, you know, this summer, like most, like all summers so far, we're doing these like little 1 or 2 day things, staycations, as they say, hate that word, but we're doing that kind of stuff because we just can't afford the bigger stuff, you know? And we're doing that, you know, as much as we can, but it just really doesn't take the place. I mean, there's no like a whole week off for anybody in my family. It just doesn't exist anymore for me or my wife. Just it doesn't happen. And we just can't imagine it, you know, even though we work in a place that has a little bit more vacation compared to most American corporations, and it's still not nearly enough, and you can use it up very, very quick, and then you're in the hole trying to dig back and, you know, dig in and not take any for a long time. This will sound familiar to a lot of people, and that's very difficult as well, because with kids especially, you need the flexibility to take time off. But even without, you know, even without kids, you need time off. And I'm aware of like people I work with that are in the hole now on vacation time. And it's pretty sad. But anyway, we're also going to talk about something that didn't, as far as I could see, in the corporate media and in the even the left media, so to speak, social media and so on, I didn't see much referencing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the anniversary of those horrible, the horrible attacks on with atomic bombs on two cities in Japan at the end of World War II. And I just want to, like, you know, do a quick thing on that and a little bit of memory about that. And then, continue our independent politics discussion. And also, I've had this article. It's definitely from sort of a, anarcho-syndicalist point of view, but might have some interesting history. And if we have time to get to it, when and why did unions start signing contracts? In other words, unions used to organize and fight for things and win some things without signing contracts, legal contracts with companies. And then also we, Dow will have time for this, but maybe next time. I found this interesting article on, just the title will give you the ideas from, it was republished in this website I like called the Hampton Institute, also a Facebook page, the Hampton Institute, H-A-M-P-T-O-N, named after Fred Hampton, the Black Panther leader that was murdered in Chicago by the Chicago police when he was only, I think Hampton was only like 21 years old or 20 years old, and already a really brilliant leader, Marxist, and really knew how to use socialism in an organizing way. He organized multiracial movements in Chicago, helped organize multiracial movements in Chicago. And he was so effective that they just felt they had to get rid of him. And there's been a movie called The Murder of Fred Hampton. There's also a couple books, I think with the same title perhaps, Murder of Fred Hampton, one that just came out within the last couple of years. You should try to look at that if you get a chance. Let's get going here. I'm almost tempted to start off with a song because I have to do this little technical thing here to make our sound quality a little better. Maybe I'll just sneak off and leave dead air on instead of do a 3-minute song. So excuse one moment, please. No, I don't have an engineer to do interesting things for me here for the show. It's not like what was that show from the 90s, Frasier, where he had a nice engineer doing all this technical stuff for him. Doesn't happen like that. In a lot of places. But you're listening again to WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. We're a little slice of that community-based. We are socialist alternative radio, talking music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective. Our showtime this summer and hopefully in the fall will be from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. every other Sunday. And we've been on the air different times for... since about 2006, I was just mentioning to previous Ear Buddies DJ that was here, one of the Ear Buddies DJs, about that, the history of the show here. And it's been, a good history. We have gotten feedback through people listening directly to the show, people listening on Facebook, feedback internationally because of the internet. Of course, you can listen live stream. Go to WMFO.org. Listen to the last show, should be archived. And then also there's the live stream. And, that's, we know we've influenced a few people. A few people have said to us, I got involved, I joined Social Alternative because this is a show, or I really listen to your show a lot and get a lot out of it, stuff like that. We really appreciate that. There's also, passive listeners that have been, influenced or that just check us out of curiosity. That's welcome too, but we do make this sort of qualifier about our show that we talk about a lot. There are other, believe it or not, there's a few, let's say very, very few. With podcasts now, we could say maybe more than a few, but there are other shows that try to put forward socialist ideas or somewhat left-wing ideas, or how they understand them to be left-wing ideas. And that's good. I don't really have a handle on the whole podcast universe. I've been reading lately a little bit about how there's so many out there now that it's hard to get big audiences or get listenerships for a lot of them, especially obviously for newer ones or whatever. But I'm sure there's ways that people are doing that, probably linking it into other platforms, quote unquote. I hate that word too, but they will say platforms. and generating some buzz. I know that I know someone that listens to this sort of true crime podcast that got publicized on NPR a little bit. So I think if your podcast gets publicized and you do actually advertising for it, you can create a little buzz for it. But we're not a podcast. We're going out live over the air, which I think is really good. I think that the airwaves are, even under capitalism, supposed to be public. Of course, that's a complete joke. They're rented out to routinely outsourced and so on to the richest in capitalist society. So you have this little part, a little sort of on the left-hand side of the dial on the radios all over the country in the U.S. Maybe, if you're lucky, some sort of, you know, left-wing radio show. And that's only in a proud, I don't know, a handful of areas, maybe more. Again, not talking about podcasts. And basically you're going through universities that have these licenses to have radio shows, again, with low frequency, left-hand side of the dial usually. And you know, there's a few universities that, like Emerson, for example, I don't know how they do this, but they get wide, they have a big signal that takes up many radio stations. They actually own more than one signal, it sounds like to me, Emerson College, and that is a communications school. I've never heard any political programming on Emerson College Radio, although I don't listen to all of it. There might be some. I'd be glad to be proven wrong on that. But what my point is that by and large, any kind of left-wing, and I mean that in a good sense, political programming is going to be buried on low-frequency stations, left-hand side of the dial, if you get it at all. And so we hope that Social Alternative Radio has, you know, pushed that a little bit further out, gotten people exposed to socialist ideas that might not have heard of them. Unfortunately, in the United States, even with the internet, it's hard to run into socialist ideas in a coherent, action-oriented way. And that's what I was going to say earlier, that the qualifier for our show is not just that we're trying to provide alternative information, alternative news, so to speak. There's of the shows that are out there that are nominally left-wing or really are left-wing, the amount that are putting forward information and then sort of like, hey, we're going to put out this information that sounds progressive and lefty sort of, and then that's all we're going to do, and that's fine. I mean, that's okay, but I find that very limited. I think that anyone that wants to advocate a position, and everyone does advocate a position, whether they admit it or not, including the corporate journalists, quote-unquote, that anyone advocating a position should also be advocating something to do about it. You know, it doesn't do any, you know, it just doesn't do any good to talk about a problem and not talk about possible solutions, ways to get involved, and so on. So with a socialist radio show, Socialist Alternative Radio, we like to stress we're not just giving out information or doing analysis on the air and whatever. We are also, you know, trying to get you interested, quite frankly, into becoming a socialist. And that means not just a socialist who, you know, and I don't blame people. It's hard to find organizations, especially in the United States, but not just a socialist who's going to like work the internet and the Facebook world, but is going to also go out and organize openly as a socialist. Maybe even run for office, but openly as a socialist, you know, as an independent socialist or as a socialist as part of an organization, like Shama Sawan out in Seattle, running for city council re-election. And that's a little bit different, and that can be with no mass left party in this country, no mass workers party. It's not easy to get tied into socialist a big socialist movement or big socialist groups or small socialist groups even without that pole of attraction that exists in other countries of left parties, even left parties that were traditionally revolutionary, that have lost their goal and their purpose. There's still kind of this memory that, well, at one point they were that way, or they still might be that way in the future if certain things happen. I'm not at all making an analogy to the Democratic Party. Some of our listeners, I'm sure, think, you know, the Democratic Party is a real sort of party, that it's somehow liberal left or something, leftish maybe. Like the Wall Street Journal was calling the Democrats you know, left-wing in an editorial the other day. And no, Democratic Party is, if you just take a cursory glance at its history, It started as the party of slaveholders. It was the party then of the of a wing of the capitalists, and has remained so ever since, once capitalism got going. And it has its times and moments of running left populist candidates. Bernie Sanders is not a new phenomena at all. Some people think he is, but he's not. There was, you know, you can think of on a state level, Upton Sinclair running for governor of California as a Democrat in the Depression. But he was a well-known socialist, so he was, you know, I'm going to use the Democratic Party, I'm going to reform it, etc. He lost, he didn't reform it. It's impossible to reform a party with no membership. It's possible to reform a party with no direct affiliations to, you know, community or working class organizations in general, whether they're community-based or unions or whatever. The Democratic Party has no formal affiliations to those, although a lot of, if you're a union member like me, a lot of your dues money gets dumped into the Democratic Party, which is in my opinion, giving money back to the corporate elite, giving money back to the big bosses who are your enemy. So it makes no sense for the union, the labor movement, to be giving money to the Democratic Party, and yet that happens, giving human resources to the Democratic Party around election times happens as well. I completely object to that. It's completely counterproductive. It's helping. It's equivalent of sleeping with the enemy. But it happens, of course, all the time. But still, there's no formal, you know, you don't get anything formally for that. You know, the unions can say they buy influence, they buy loyalty. They don't. I've seen so many instances of the Democratic Party stabbing the labor movement in the back, locally, statewide, nationally. Think of the Obama administration, big union support for Obama in his first and second runs for office, where he won both. As president, talking about presidency here. And the Obama administration ran the first time with the promise, and this was the main thing that the union leaders used to corral support for the Obama administration, to give donations and to get some members out to do political work on the campaigns, was this thing called the Employee Free Choice Act, EFCA. And this was going to, through various legal measures, if it ever got passed, which is part of the problem of putting all your eggs into a basket like that, saying, well, okay, hey, you're going to run on this legislation, you know, this is the main thing that we're tying our support for you for, and you're going to, because, you know, Obama wouldn't come out for, like, universal health care or anything. I mean, the labor movement was tying itself with a very tenuous thread to the Obama campaign, and the thread was EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act, and some laws that would have to get changed in labor law to make it easier to organize a union. And they were, on paper, good changes. So the labor movement, instead of fighting for this through a campaigning way nationally, I don't mean electoral campaign, I mean mass protest, mass movement way, putting up its own candidates to push this through, creating a third party, which would have a volcanic, what's the metaphor I'm looking for, be an earthquake in U.S. politics, to get a third, a progressive or socialist third party, or, you know, just anti-capitalist or third party, or, you know, anything to the left of the Democrats almost, would be a big step forward. And like in Canada, when that happened in 1964, quick digression here, in Canada, when that happened in 1964, the New Democratic Party, running on the need for national health care, bringing together different progressive and left groups, but also labor, or a big chunk of labor, was able to, just in its formation, accelerate real healthcare reform in Canada, to the point where there is now, there was, even back in the 60s, a National Healthcare Act passed, where Canadians have much better healthcare than in the U.S., and with almost no cost to them. It's just part of your benefits as a society. There's taxes, but the taxes are not as high as people think on individuals. The healthcare system is paid for as a government program. However, I have to always add the caveat, whether you're talking about Canada, Britain, or any other country, and there are many, many around the world that have national health care plans, universal health care. You know, your right as a citizen is also a right to health care. The problems are that they never just stay there in stasis. Even though, like in Canada, you have huge popularity of the national health care system there, including among conservatives, doesn't prevent the conservatives in political power and the corporate their corporate bosses from chipping away at that when they feel they can't do more than chip away at it, and really take gouges out of it when they feel they can, in terms of funding, in terms of setting up private parallel systems, in terms of weakening it any way they can to go back to some sort of private system. And they would swear on a stack of Bibles that's not their goal, but it is. And they sometimes they can say it openly, sometimes they can't, sometimes they can push farther in cutting funding and so on than at other times. And the usual way they do it is they cut funding so much and create parallel systems of privatized healthcare for the rich, an upper middle class maybe, that they've underfunded the general population's healthcare so much that there's people get angry about the quality deteriorating. And they say, well, something is better than this. This is the secret to privatization everywhere. And it doesn't have to be healthcare, it could be mass transit, it could be whatever. People are not, clued into or educated, or a lot of people, about, you know, the direct relationship between actual decisions made to cut funding, cut taxes on the rich and the big corporations, et cetera, in order to, not fund properly social programs like in countries that have universal health care or national health care, not to cut the funding to those, create less quality. People get fed up. They get manipulated. They get promised things that will never happen under private health care. And then, boom, you've lost public health care or portions of it as a prelude to losing more of it. And because we never even gained public health care here, we never even gained the right to health care, which is going to seem absurd in future generations if we survive as a species here, if we survive under capitalism. It will probably be looked back on the time, this huge amount of time in the United States that there was no public health care system, no free health care for everybody. That was an incredibly barbaric time. And how did that happen? And how did they let those criminals get away with it? How are they making money off sick people? How are people dying because they couldn't afford things? I saw a thing today on gum disease, right? Big report, new report on gum disease. Because the news always has these reports that want to uplift capitalism, uplift your opinion about the system and the future and make you feel good about the horrible injustices that exist if they bother to talk about them. So I'm watching TV news and hey, there's this new thing where you can use a laser procedure to, make gum disease much less painful, contribute to regeneration of healthy tissue growth, only have the procedure done once in a lifetime, all this major promises, and I'm waiting for it. Wait for it. Yeah, $2,000 to $6,000, right, for one procedure, and your insurance isn't going to cover all of it. So, yeah, we're going to just drop another $6,000, we're going to drop $6,000 or whatever, and that's if you find the dentist that will do it. There's no law that says a dentist, your dentist or a dentist down the street, has to even use this technology. And if they're saying it's $2,000, $6,000, I guarantee you it's more than that. So, again, you're looking at a situation where the formation, back to the original point, the formation of a third party in Canada propelled enormous reforms, which are under threat at all times under capitalism, but at least for a time, got in and still exists a national healthcare system in Canada. So you had like Sanders, for example, just led a, and this is not a plug for Sanders, because Sanders is running as a Democrat. If Sanders ran as independent, you'd hear a lot of plugs for Sanders on this show. But Sanders just did a thing that other people have done in the past, which is a good thing, of going up to Canada and in a group publicizing it to get insulin medication at a much, much, much cheaper, to get insulin at a much, much, much cheaper rate than you get in the United States. And these were Americans going up there. These weren't even Canadian citizens. And they could still buy it. So Canadian citizens that would pay even less or maybe nothing. I have to double check on that. So we would gain so much in this country to have a party to the left of the Democrats, a real membership-based kind of, mass left party of some sort, a workers' party. By workers' party, that's shorthand for like socialist parties, communist party, labor party, whatever the name would be, that would be based on the working class and no money from the corporations, that would be anti-capitalist or else going in that direction, that would not be getting money, would have some links to the labor movement and to other movements that are progressive and that would help fund it. And that's what we need. And instead, we are stuck with, again and again, lesser evilism the two-party duopoly instead of a monopoly of one party. It's two. They work very hard to keep that going, they being the capitalists. And you find big corporations giving money to both parties routinely. You know, the differences between the parties that do exist at sometimes more than others. And they can be real on certain issues, but where they come together uniformly is on the capitalist system. I mean, even Sanders is calling for a political revolution. Notice that's not a social revolution, which would be getting rid of capitalism. And when pressed to talk about socialism, he mentions liberal capitalists like FDR, who had no interest in socialism, except to try to stop it. And so we are caught in the United States with no pressure coming from the left on the ruling class, and no mass workers' party. But here and there, there are independents that run, maybe a left-green party member, maybe a independent left socialist, and look for those in the election. I will be. For example, Hobby Hawkins might run as green, although they're having their primary thing, and he's one of the people running. He's ran as a socialist in the past. He considered himself an eco-socialist, member of the Green Party, left green. There's two socialists running out in Ohio, a place called Athens, Ohio, that I've been reading about. Still don't know a lot about those campaigns. Been meaning to check more into them. And invariably, there's more than we ever hear about, because the corporate media is not running out and saying, hey, there's a socialist running here. Although, with the growth of DSA, Democratic Socialist America, which is really tied to the Democratic Party, they will call people running as Democrats socialists sometimes. You'll see that happen in the media. Even that's kind of rare, but I find that extremely misleading. Once you run as a Democrat, or as long as you run as a Democrat, you're not a socialist. You just can't be in a capitalist political party like that and then claim to be a socialist. It doesn't work. You will be doing work for that party. You will be promoting that party. You will be bringing people into that party as voters. There's no membership, but as voters in the Democratic Party realm. And supporting all sorts of issues that will not help working people, that will hurt working people and will hurt the planet. And that's what's happening with you can find the most left-wing Democrat you want, Sanders, AOC, whoever, and they get sucked into votes for continuing military spending at a huge rate, a record rate, or votes for other regressive things politically that are just hurting working people, and then try to maintain sort of left or socialist credentials at the same time. Doesn't work that way. Now, if tomorrow Sanders decided to run as an independent, which he should have done in 2016, and which he still should do, then, like I said earlier, yeah, that would be great. Especially if he's running to build a party and not just running for himself. That would be brilliant. And we would be able to, I think, rally many millions of people around a truly democratic socialist program and campaign. And, you know, it makes me nervous to tie that into one individual. But if that was that had to be the triggering event, of high profile that Sanders has now, splitting with the Democratic Party or leaving the Democratic Party is more accurate, because there's, again, no membership in the Democrats. That would be, except for the politicians. It's ironic. I say no membership in the Democrats, but if you run as a Democratic Party politician and you win, then you're eligible to be on the DNC, which really controls the Democratic Party, this internal ruling elite, and they can appoint others. But the average person, no, they can only register to vote Democrat. You can't be a member of the Democratic Party in any real sense. You can, in some cities or places, go and get involved with other Democrats, and they can make decisions. And it's all, you know, it's all based on influence and not real power, based on endorsing someone and then trying to say this is who this group of Democrats in this area supports or whatever. But fundamentally, at the end of the day, it's the office holders in the areas, the official party apparatus, which is not elected, and the DNC. So that is, well, the official party apparatus can include some elected politicians, but the point is that you're not a member of the Democratic Party voting for the next leadership, voting for the next, deciding who's going to run even, basically. I mean, that's decided pretty much for you. And, you know, I hear the term, like, our democracy thrown around a lot, because for a variety of reasons, part of it is the influence of Trump and the Trump regime trying to push things to the right rhetorically. You know, he's always got the nationalist rhetoric going and the racist rhetoric and all that going. And that has an effect on some people. Also, the fact that right now, even though a lot of people are struggling economically, I mean, tens of millions of people are struggling economically in the United States, maybe even 100 million people or more, living paycheck to paycheck and so on. I've heard different figures, 40% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, that sort of thing. We have the nominal, on the surface, propagandistically speaking, economic boom. So whenever that is going on and people believe it, which some do, there's this tendency for, you know, a kind of drift to the right of some people, and, you know, they feel comfortable talking about our democracy and pretend there's real choices out there, when by the time you vote as an individual for president, those choices have been made already by powerful people with a lot of money in terms of the duopoly. Again, if we get a workers' party going, that blows that out of the water. And you might just have, if you're a member of the party, and I think it would cause other parties to form as well, which would be good if they're progressive, left, independent, and so on. Then we would have a lot of more people in this country could say that they actually do participate in the democratic process in a democratic way. You can't call a democracy when you have locked up the decision making of who's going to run so clearly, as it's locked up in the United States, based on, again, who the corporations want, who the super rich want, and the various ways they put barriers up and stop others from running. I'm not just thinking of Sanders here, because Sanders has worked his way, even before he ran for president, into the accepted elite of people that the bourgeois, the you know, big business, big corporations felt they could trust. And he became, you know, after getting in their face and running as an independent in Vermont for mayor, he eventually, when he tried to run for higher office and saw what was going on from his point of view with the resources needed and so on, he hooked up with the Democrats back in 1992. And even before that, he was making pro-Democrat. He endorsed Mondale in 1984, for example, that sort of thing. So once 1992 hit, though, it was clearly like, well, this deal with the Democrats that if when Sanders runs in Vermont, they won't run anyone against him, but he in turn will support their policy, their candidates, their national candidates in Vermont, within Vermont. So I read of one instance of a progressive woman who tried to run against Sanders and couldn't even get a return phone call from the corporate media, much less any help from other Democrats, even though she was a Democrat, registered as a Democrat, you know, in terms of voting, again, no membership. But an activist in I believe the Burlington area up in Vermont. So a lot of candidates are just immediately kept outside of any sort of in the duopoly. They're kept outside of the two-party system and on the fringes. You can see that happening with the Democrats now, because a lot of the candidates, there's so many candidates running, and every once in a while one will pop up. You'll hear a name. Like, I'm getting, like, on TV, I was watching ads from a guy who's running. I never heard of him. He doesn't get any media coverage, but he's rich enough to put ads on. And he's a Democrat. And then there's another Democrat who I just heard on the radio, about on the radio over here, over to the show, that I never heard of before, who, you know, they just decided, oh, it's quirky Sunday, slow news day. Let's do a little quirky thing on this person, you know, stressing that he has no chance of winning, so sort of, you know, damned by faint praise or whatever that phrase goes. And so, you know, you give the illusion of choice, you know, in a country of 350 million to have a system, the whole way it's designed is flawed. It's not really democracy to begin with. But even within that system, if you buy into it, then there's other ways that you can see, well, no, you're not, you don't get anywhere. You don't get to choose who's going to run. It's chosen for you. And then people really get behind that choices that are chosen for them. They try to make distinctions and hope for the best, and I can understand that. Good, you know, people want to try to improve things, and they think that voting will do that, and voting could do that if you had, you know, mass democracy, if you had in every area sort of, you know, mass councils of working people that got together regularly. They had the leisure time basically to do that as well. That's a key factor in a real democracy. And get together and make decisions and then elect representatives to other bodies and so on, but on a much wider basis than the Congress is, and without the so-called checks and balances to stop actual popular votes, and not just for individuals, but for policies from going through and becoming the you know, I hate to say law, but I'll use that term, the law of the of an area or a country or a part of the world, and interlocking all that kind of basic mass democracy at each level, local, some sort of regional level, and then a national level, and looking at internationally. That's really what socialism is about. That's what democracy, real democratic socialism, is about, or socialist democracy before that got corrupted as a term. Having an international real democracy on a mass scale, and people having a say locally, but even internationally, in what's going on. And there would still be some sort of representative democracy there, but it would not be based on money. It would be based on the popular, you know, what groups really people want to elect to make decisions in between times where they make them directly, you know, in big meetings, big, you know, local, regional, national meetings. And it's a whole different model, whole different, you know, way it would be funded, and the labor that would go into it would be very, very different from what happens under capitalist systems, where the, you know, people have fought hard for rights to vote and so on, but right from the start they were working under a flawed model, and that the votes, the rights that we win through bloody struggle turn out to be, at the end of when the smoke clears, turn out to be minimal and still fitting into the capitalist system in some way, and help, therefore helping the capitalists. And that's what all you, by the way, that's what all your talk of reforming the Democratic Party, splitting the Democratic Party and all that is, that the minute you support a Democratic Party candidate, you're helping build a Democratic Party. You cannot divorce the candidate from the party. It's impossible. In fact, especially with the Democratic Party, where it only is an electoral machine, it's not a membership-based party. But here and there, as we talked about, there are independent socialists running, or somewhat independent socialists running, that are not obviously tied to the Democratic Party and running without corporate funding. And in the case of Shama Sawant, who we mentioned before, Shama has actually been elected twice and served as a a member of the city council, but on a worker's wage, only accepting the wage, the average wage of the people she represents in her district, and before that was citywide, and giving the rest away to social justice causes, to community groups, to socialist campaigns and so on. Not campaigns, but, you know, socialist issues that socialists take up, or non-socialists, if it's progressive in Seattle. And no other candidate does this. From what I can tell from the Shama Sawant campaign right now, it could really use more publicity on that fact. But it's well known that Shama's not taking any corporate money, and well known that Amazon, the big corporation, and other big corporations like Microsoft and so on, have really keyed in on trying to stop Shama from getting elected. I think I read today that there's actually three corporate political action committees, or PACs, that are going after. Their philosophy is anybody but Shama, is what they're really operating under. And so there was a open primary in Seattle, and even though Shama runs as an independent, as a socialist, as a member of Social Alternative, she gets tossed into that primary vote because it's the capitalist way of narrowing down the field. And Shama won the primary, coming in first place, 9 points ahead. This is these figures I'm giving might change a little bit. 9 points ahead of the nearest opponent in a six-way race, and this guy who basically you can think of as the Amazon candidate, Egon Orion, Orion, got only 23% of the vote. Shama Sawant getting 32.75%, and that's probably how the general election will be between Shama Sawant and Egon Orion in this district. And this is a powerful, Shama's campaign has been a powerful grassroots campaign, focusing on rent control. And this is a big fight because the state of Washington, like the state of Massachusetts, where our show emanates from here, has passed rules in the laws in the past to try to stop rent control. They have successfully done that. And one of the main reasons one of the main ways they've done that is to say, oh, if you want rent control, it has to be statewide. You can't pass rent control in a city. Well, that's really democratic. Thanks a lot. And obviously they do that so they can get votes from conservative areas that where rent control is not really an issue to with a lot of propaganda, get those areas to vote against rent control. It's exactly what happened in Massachusetts, where cities that still had rent control in the late 1990s, or was it the mid-1990s? I have to double check my chronology, but in the 90s, let's say, to cover my base there, rent control was very popular and kept passing when votes would challenge it, votes based on the big real estate corporations were very powerful in the Boston area, real estate, insurance companies, universities, you know. And they all came out against rent control, and the elements of the Democratic Party, lots of Democrats came out against rent control too. And but it kept getting passed. It kept, you know, every time it would be challenged, it would survive in most cities. That had it. Boston, Cambridge, Brookline. I think there was a city in Western Mass that had it as well. And before that, there was a few others that did get successfully destroyed on a city level, but that was rare. That was rare. And so what did they do? Hey, let's make it statewide. Let's make the vote statewide. Oh, well, okay. And why does somebody in a smaller city where there isn't a crisis, you know, doesn't matter. Well, we'll include them in the vote. And not only that, but say it has to be a statewide vote. It cannot be a citywide vote. And that was really what killed rent control. And it was still fairly close, the vote. And Washington State has the same thing going. So the fight that Shama Sawant's campaign is leading, and Social Alternative being a part of that, is to get the law changed on the state level. And you got to remember, Shama's just one socialist in the whole Seattle City Council, and one socialist, really, in the entire state of Washington. So it's an uphill battle, but we're doing our best, and it's getting a lot of support, especially in Seattle, of course, but also the idea of changing it statewide, which has to happen for it to change in Seattle. And there are other issues like free mass transit, Green New Deal type of, with a sort of socialist program to, deal with what Seattle and others are dealing with. And the rent control demand, by the way, is other cities deal with. Rent control demand is linked also to all sorts of demands around building affordable housing. And that's a big crisis in Seattle. There's a lot of, I won't say a lot, but when some media gets released on the homeless crisis in the United States, you will get pictures usually from LA and Seattle. It seems to me, this is clearly anecdotal, but it just seems to me that, you know, someone who reads the corporate media and does the stuff on the internet, including and the social media like Facebook. I don't do all the social media out there. No one has time for that. But you see pictures of Seattle. Sometimes the reason is it's such an obvious contrast. You have a city like Seattle with incredible gentrification, incredible wealth concentrated in the hands of these massive corporations like Amazon, who headquarters there, Microsoft, who headquarters there, and other big corporations. And yet people living on the streets, people losing their apartments, people with jobs losing their apartments and their houses and so on. They can't afford to keep up with the payments or the property taxes or whatever. Gentrification is a very insidious thing. It's not just always, rich IT 20-something workers are coming into your neighborhood to take it over by being willing to pay high rents. That is a factor in a lot of places, but how do the apartments empty out that they can rent? And that's where, landlords, because there's no rent control, landlords just jack up the rent, assuming, and they'll leave places completely empty for a long time, just waiting for the big payoff, of gentrification of rich people moving into an area. They will push on the rents until you've got people living in, I've in Boston where rents are really superly high, including greater Boston area, really, really horribly high, really hurting people. I've heard of and seen situations where you'd sometimes, especially with immigrants, but not solely immigrants, you'd go into an apartment and there would be bunk beds in the bedrooms. So you'd have like three people, maybe two, three, four people to a bedroom, all, contributing to the rent. So then you have maybe a two-bedroom or a three-bedroom even, or maybe a one-bedroom. And that's cuts into the, you know, that cuts down the rent. But then you've also got people sleeping in like maybe the living room, or somebody sleeping in a what used to be a closet or something. It gets really ridiculous, the overcrowding of people cramming in to try to afford the rent that keeps going up and up and up all the time, relentlessly. No pun intended. So if that's even a pun, anyway. So it's really just a horrible situation. And, you know, you've seen the reports, perhaps, if you follow, if you're on social media that's progressive at all, whatever, you've probably seen the reports that there's not one city in the United States where you can rent an apartment on minimum wage. Now, usually there's a little qualifier there, whether it's an apartment, whether it's a studio or one bedroom or whatever, you know, so, you know, maybe there's some sort of mitigating circumstance. But I think I've seen it for even studios, that there's nowhere in the country where you can make a minimum wage and afford on your own an apartment, you know. So this is new. And then what's happened in the past, you know, is weird things have happened on the fringes of that gentrification or whatever in a city or in an area of, like I just said, people doubling, tripling up, horrible overcrowding, or single room. They used to call them single room occupancy buildings that are in, you know, bad shape. And, you know, you'll get shoved into maybe a basement or a really small studio, and again, people tend to double up if they have to survive, and it just creates this horrible conditioning. And then the final straw, of course, is you can't even find that situation, and you end up on the street, including many people with jobs. And so in places where, like California and Seattle, where the weather's a little more temperate, usually, parts of California, of course, you'll see these people living in cars, living in tents, to the point where you'll see huge tent cities, just like, you know, what they used to call Hoovervilles in the Depression, existing now, not in the Depression, but in a supposed economic upswing with supposedly low unemployment. Again, low unemployment doesn't help you if you can't afford the rent with a job, you know. And, you know, low unemployment doesn't pay the rent. You have to have a wage that does. And the weakening of unions, and some of you, of course, are familiar with this, the weakening of unions has meant less ability for workers to, as a general class, to organize for higher wages. Even at the height of the labor movement, you only had 35% of the workforce organized in the United States into unions. And that was enough, though, to put enough pressure, especially within certain industries where they would have organized like 80% or something, or 70%, where the equation was like, okay, the non-union places have to match or come close to what the union places get, or they can't attract enough workers. You know, and this would be in different, even in times of recession, the general thing. But that was only for a short time. There's only like the post-war upswing period, where there were recessions, but they were smaller. And, you know, starting in 74, 75, big recession. And ever since then, the unions weakening through attacks and so on by big business, through, you know, arbitrary changes in labor law. Well, not so arbitrary, but I mean arbitrary in the sense of not making any sense. Weakening unions to the point where union density is so low in everywhere but the public sector that and even there it's too low to make up for, to have the state or the corporation say, to get workers in the door and to keep them, we need to raise wages and benefits up to near union levels or at union levels. They don't make that equation doesn't work anymore. It only worked for a short time, unfortunately. But the stronger the unions get in any country, the better the living standards get for working people. And that, you know, there have been more strikes. Last year, in 2018, there were more strikes than any time since 1986. I hesitate to say that we're in a resurgence of the labor movement, but there are things happening here and there that make you think maybe that's happening. Certainly more positive people are more positive about unions in general. And we do have the big examples of the West Virginia teacher strike, Stop and Shop strike, and others that won victories and helped people live better lives, honestly. And a lot of that is through wage increases, obviously. Now, going back to Shama Sawant, this report on she won a six-way race in her district for a open primary. She's not a Democrat. She's a socialist, a socialist alternative member who ran as such, as an open socialist, as a member of Social Alternative. and got 32. Chama got 32.75% in a six-way race. Now, again, the figures might change a little bit. You should check out the media in Seattle. Go look up Chama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A, first name, S-A-W-A-N-T, second name. And she'll be facing an Amazon candidate. And why does that resonate so much in Seattle, by the way? It's not just what I was just describing, the housing crisis in Seattle, despite huge corporations existing there. It's because also that Chama Sawant led a successful tax Amazon initiative last year. Was it last year or earlier this year? I can't remember. It was within the last year. And this won. Even the Democrats were too embarrassed not to vote for this, and they voted for it. It was a mild tax on Amazon. Amazon went nuts. Jeff Bezos went crazy and did this whole using all that money to buy off union, some union leaders even, but also others, to go out and make it seem like this was a bad thing. Yeah, you don't want to tax the richest company in the world and the richest individual in the world. That's not right. We can't have that. So as insane as it sounds, all the Democrats retreated. Within a few months of after passing that, they all retreated except one, and her and Chama Sawant voted to keep the Amazon tax, and it got voted down. And so Amazon is now really trying hard through corporate political action committees and so on to have anybody but Chama in the district she's running in. But the grassroots campaign that is being run through the campaign, through Socialist Alternative helping and others, the movement for rent control and more affordable housing is huge. There have been and other issues that matter. There have been more in district donations than any campaign Chama's run in the past, and more than any other candidate, I believe. Last time that was checked, and that's important. In district meaning in the district she's running in, Chama Sawant is running in, but also there's this thing that, you know, because she has a high profile as a socialist, they say, oh, you know, this is all outsiders that support her. Now, first of all, nothing wrong with outsiders supporting a socialist. I would support a socialist anywhere, anytime, a real socialist. But it's just a lie that there's a lot of, and I helped out with the last re-election campaign. I went door to door. Chama's well known. People support what, I mean, let's give a little history. I mean, Chama Sawant got elected in 2013, I believe it was, based on support, largely, there was a lot of different, Chama Sawant ran as a member of Social Alternative on a, you know, general kind of socialist program for city council with a lot of different issues. But at the time, the issue that really captured the imagination of people in Seattle was the need for a $15 an hour minimum wage. And there had been a vote in a neighboring city that won, but then got overturned by the courts, which was really horrible. So this was a second chance and a good chance, and in a bit much bigger city, Seattle, to get a $15 an hour minimum wage. And it was a very popular Chama Sawant ran on a lot of different issues and made sure that 15 wasn't the only one, but it was became clear that was the most important one to most people. So winning the campaign was a signal that to the city and to the state and anyone else listening, the people of Seattle wanted a $15 minimum wage. So Socialist Alternative and others and Chama Sawant herself took that campaign and this the successful election campaign, which, by the way, she ran as a real underdog and still won as an open socialist again, as a member of Social Alternative, and took that campaign and turned it into a 15 now campaign, meaning $15 minimum wage campaign. And that was won, I believe, in very quickly, like 2014, maybe 2015, early. And that got watered down a bit when the Democrats finally got their hands on it, but it still passed. It was the first $15 minimum wage law in the country, and immediately started helping thousands of workers, and is still, because of phase-in, still getting totally phased in, but has already helped tens of thousands of workers, maybe even hundreds of thousands in Seattle. And I'll keep to tens of thousands because I don't know the population of Seattle, but it's a huge section of the workforce being helped by a law that says you must pay a $50 minimum wage. And there's still a couple sectors of the workforce, I believe, that are being phased in. But overall, it's helped a lot of people, a ton of people, and it's really great. So Chama's known for that, but there's been other issues, many other issues since then. So for these corporate-backed candidates to go after Chama Sawant, anybody but Chama Sawant, all that kind of thing, you know, it's amazing. It's great. And shows the hard work that went into getting a 32.75% election in a six-way race in her district. And there's only six people running because of that, again, that push from the corporations to try to get her out, get Shama out. And it's not working so far, and we hope it will not work. And there's already been a lot of unions supporting Shama now that there's been a primary. We hopefully can get more union endorsements. There will be more union endorsements probably for Shama Sawant. And the general election that's coming up, it's going to have hopefully a clear basis of this Amazon candidate versus a working class candidate for the working class. And the Chamber of Congress and Amazon and their candidate, Egon Orion, they are all lined up raising more money than you'd ever imagine for a city council race to try to defeat Shama Sawant and roll back the important victories that have been won in Seattle. Already there have been victories for affordable housing, for $15 minimum wage, for many other things. And yet election is elections can be obviously heavily influenced by big money, and this, and they're trying their best with the big money through the corporate PACs to political action committees to get rid of Shama Sawant. So I'd urge you to check that out. That is an example of independent socialist politics in Seattle, and an example of what could be done on a state, national, other cities, and also on a state and national basis, because we can't, you know, despite one of the problems with not having a workers' party of some sort is that we don't have a lot of the things that concrete fundable resources that come out of a big party like that, like alternative views on historical subjects, news and information about campaigns and things that people want and need that doesn't make it into the corporate media. So in other words, your own media, your own kind of educational resources and so on come out of those big parties. That's why in Europe and other countries that have multiple parties, including workers' parties, there tends to be, and that can change and is changing because in some countries they're weakened, that there tends to be more a higher class consciousness among the working class. You know, if you have more unions and more political parties that represent you and that are not in the pocket of the corporations, then like the Democrats and Republicans are, then that leads you to think of yourself as, oh, I don't have as much in common with this upper middle class or rich person than the Democratic Party or the Republican Party would have me believe. There's this other party out there that says, wait a minute, we're the ones that do the work, right? We're the ones that are paying the vast majority of taxes, which is ridiculous. Let's turn that around and give the workers more power and tax the big corporations, the super rich, because they get their money from exploiting our labor and also exploiting our land in the sense of our nature in general being no one person can own all the big land in a country. That's really public resources. So public resources are routinely used in capitalism, under capitalism, to enrich the capitalist class, a few at the top. And that's really wrong. And so if you get a workers' party, and a lot of these issues that seem separate kind of get tied together. If you even just organize a successful workers' party, maybe it doesn't get power right away. Like the NDP in Canada didn't get power right away, the New Democratic Party. But it brings all these different issues together that are important to working people. I mean, I could list, like, I was just talking about healthcare, and then I mentioned the aspect of dental care. I mean, I could mention all these things that, you know, senior care, child care, all these things that college. I mean, you know, I'm you know, again, coming into the show, listening to the radio, and it says something about on the radio about saving for college. Is that at the same time I'm saving for my retirement? Is that at the same time I'm saving for elder care? You know, is that the same time I'm paying back, because my kids are a little older now, paying back for the child care that I paid thousands of dollars for every month? I mean, what's going on? I mean, this is just ridiculous. We're supposed to, our check can only get sliced so many ways, you know, Come on. And that's the answer for everything. Save more, slice up your check more, put some more away. You can't put it away. You got to spend it on groceries. You got to spend it on gas money. If you have to drive, you got to spend it on public transportation, which just went up again in Boston, et cetera. Hey, we're going to stop for 1 second. This is WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford. Those are our two legal IDs. And we are also more or less formally...